Okay, I hope we'll finish up with NMR spectroscopy here today. But I've inserted one slide at the last moment, having looked at wikis. I think I didn't make something sufficiently clear about what influences positions of peaks, about dipole coupling. So here are two dipoles. Okay. Now, a spin 1/2 magnet has no interaction with the molecule, that with the electrons in the molecule normally. Of course, the nucleus is positioned, you know, according to bond distances, quantum mechanics, and so on, where the nucleus should be. Right? It's positioned, but it's not oriented. The magnet doesn't feel the molecule. Okay? What does the magnet feel? The nuclear magnet, its orientation. What orients it? Not the molecule. The applied magnetic field. So it's as if it's on perfect ball bearings, right? So as the molecule tumbles like this, the nuclear magnet stays oriented by the magnetic field. It doesn't feel the molecule. Okay? Now, suppose there's some other magnet that's influencing this magnet, right? This other magnet could be magnetism from another nucleus, right? Which has nothing to do with the field other than being oriented by the field. Or it could be magnetism that's caused by the circulation of electrons about other nuclei. But again, that circulation is caused by the field. So the direction it circulates is always so as to make a field actually that's opposed to the applied field. Okay, it shows it with it here, but it would be opposed if it were caused by orienting. Of course, how much it orbits depends on where the molecular orbitals are, right? But the fact of its orbiting and the direction of its orbiting is caused by the field. Okay? So it's as if it's on ball bearings too. The magnetism from orbiting of electrons someplace else other than the nucleus we're interested in, that orbiting is also has this same direction all the time. Although if it's diamagnetically anisotropic, how much it's orbiting depends on the orientation of the molecule. Like if it's benzene and it's in the plane of the molecule, then it'll orbit a lot. But if the benzene turns perpendicular to the plane of the molecule, then it won't orbit. But still, to the extent that it's orbiting, its direction is the same. Everybody with me on this? So we're interested in the field that this magnet sees, influenced by this other magnet within the molecule, which is either due to another nucleus, which is always oriented the same way and the same strength, or by orbiting about other nuclei, which is always oriented the same way, but of different strength if it's diamagnetically anisotropic. Any questions about that? I want to make sure you understand that. Did you understand it? I don't see any neck motion. You understood it? You don't want me to say it again? Okay. We're interested. This magnet that we're interested in, what its precession frequency is, the one here, right? Its precession frequency depends on the field it sees. And far and away, the biggest component of the field is the magnetic field, this that you paid, you know, $1 million to get a big magnetic field, very homogeneous. So that's the big field. That orients it. Right? It also orients this one. Right? Now, if this other one is another nuclear magnet, it's the same story as that. Okay? If this other magnet is due to circulation of electrons about some other place other than here, right? Then it's always oriented the same way, actually down rather than up, opposing the applied field. It's always oriented the same way, but how big it is depends on can depend on the orientation of the molecule. Okay? So there are two other magnets that are influencing the field this one sees, in addition to the big magnet. The big magnet is, you know, the big story. The others are just parts per million of that, their influence. Okay? But still, we're really interested in what these others are because we want this nucleus to tell us about its environment, where this proton is. And what it sees of the environment is these other magnets, either other nuclei or the orbiting of electrons about other nuclei. And also, incidentally, the orbiting of electron about this nucleus, which is always in the same direction with respect to this nucleus. Now, what happens if the molecule tumbles? All these orientations stay the same. Right? It's as if they're on perfect ball bearings because the nuclear magnets, the nuclear positions depend on what the nature of the molecule is. You know, they're held in a certain distance for other molecules and so on according to bonds. But the orientation of the magnet doesn't depend on the rest of the molecule. It's always oriented by the magnetic field like this. Is that clear? Okay, now we're interested in, if the molecule is at a certain orientation, what influence will this field exert on this nucleus that we're interested in? Right? And for that purpose, I've drawn lines of force from this one. It would be great if I had an enormous sheet of plastic that could get all the way out here. But you get the idea. If this magnet is out here, sideways from this with respect to the applied field, then the arrows from this one are pointing down, hurting the applied field. Right? But if it orients like this, then the arrows from this one are helping the applied field. Okay? Now, how about if it's tumbling? These always stay the same orientation because they don't care about the tumbling. Right? But it goes from hurting the applied field to helping the applied field. And it's stronger here. It's stronger here. The lines of force are more concentrated than they are out here. So this is a big effect, and this would more than cancel the effect down here if we just rotated like this. But if we also allow rotation like this, then there are an enormous number of orientations of the molecule that have the field here opposed to the applied field, and only one where it's maximally strong. Here. Okay? So it turns out mathematically that averages out to zero. It averages out to zero for the through-space interaction of a nuclear magnet here, influencing the nuclear magnet here, which is measured in terms of energy. That's a certain energy, that interaction. Right? And it also averages to zero for the part that's caused by orbiting of electrons here. Right? If it's always the same, so that the mathematics will cancel it out. But if the effect of this one is big when it's here and small when it's here, then in the averaging this will win. And it'll oppose the applied field. If it's big when it's here and small when it's here, then this one will win in terms of chemical shift. And chemical shift is measured in parts per million, not in energy units, because it's caused by the field. If you make the field twice as big, the orbiting is twice as much, and the effect is twice as big. But if you measure it in fraction of the big field, right, then it's always the same. So that's why I use parts per million. So that's just a rehearsal of stuff we've talked about before, but maybe it's a little clearer if I use this model. So I'll have a picture of that. There'll be a new slide inserted in this that you haven't seen yet, this one here, and it'll have these pictures of me doing this. Okay? So now back to the normal business here. So proton decoupling. Remember that nuclei influence the field of one another, so you get splitting. Okay? So, and if you had a C13, as we saw last time, you can see the splitting, the hydrogen spectrum will show splitting by the C13. Now we can think about what's happening. The proton is doing its precession at 100 megahertz very rapidly. And the carbon, and it has an average field in this direct vertical, either up or down. And the C13 is only a quarter as strong as a magnet. So what does that mean about its precession? What about the precession if the magnet's a quarter as strong? It'll be a quarter as fast. It doesn't feel as much torque. So it goes four times slower in its precession. Okay? But it has an average field, a quarter as big as the hydrogen, up or down. Now, if you then look at the hydrogen spectrum, if you operate with radio frequency waves that are at 100 megahertz, and so you look at the proton spectrum, you see a big peak that's due to the normal carbon, C12, but 1% of the carbon is C13 and is doing this, and when it's up, you see a peak here, and when it's down, you see a peak there. Okay, so you see that C13H splitting. Now, if you use the spectrometer where the radio frequency was 25 megahertz that you were using, then you're looking at the carbon. You're not looking at the proton, and then you'll see a signal like this. Now, the H can be either all the H is proton. There's very little deuterium. It's like, I forget, 0.005% or something like that. So all the hydrogen is magnetic. In the case of carbon influencing the hydrogen spectrum, most of the carbon was not magnetic and gave this unsplit peak. But there was just 1% that gave these two, 0.5% each. Over here, all the hydrogen is either up or down, right? So you get a doublet in the C13 spectrum. The C13 sees the big field plus or minus the effect of the hydrogen. And remember, this influence of the hydrogen on the C13 or of the C13 on the hydrogen is not caused by the magnets interacting through space this way, right? Because that averaged to zero. It's going through the pair of electrons, the orbitals that are involved. One electron here, the other electron here. Therefore, this one knows the spin of that one. That's the nature of the interaction. And it depends on the carbon's S orbital percentage, because that's the only way the electron gets on the nucleus. Okay, so there's a certain splitting, and the splitting in measured in energy, as you measure splitting in hertz, is exactly the same. This splitting is 125 hertz, and this splitting is 125 hertz, and it doesn't surprise you that they're the same, because it's the same two magnets that are interacting, either favorably or unfavorably. Okay, now suppose that we use two radio frequencies. So we're going to do both things at once. Okay, what we're going to do is have a steady 100 megahertz radio signal here that irradiates the hydrogen. But while we're doing that, we're going to give a 90-degree pulse at 25 megahertz, which is going to take these magnets and flip them down into the plane, so you get precession, and then we can listen to the echoes that come from that and study the C13 spectrum. But at the same time, we're using another radio frequency to irradiate the hydrogen. Now, how do you understand how the hydrogen behaves when you put a 100 megahertz signal on like that? Remember what frame you look at, Derek? You look in the rotating frame. Okay. So in the rotating frame at 100 megahertz, it's going to look like that. In other words, the hydrogen is going to be going up and down. Right? Now, what influence is that going to have on the C13 spectrum? The fact that so we're going to make we have the 100 megahertz going up, going along, so that the hydrogen's going up, down, up, down, up, down. But then we give a pulse at 25 megahertz and take the C13s and tip them down. And now they're precessing, and we're listening to how fast they precess. And if we didn't have the hydrogen radio signal going in, then there'd be two different frequencies of carbon precessing. One where the hydrogens are up, one where their hydrogens are down. What happens if we have the 100 megahertz on at the same time? Right? Yeah, it'll average out because, you know, it's this way, then it's this way, then it's this way, then it's this way, changing back and forth rapidly, the hydrogen. So it's as if the hydrogen weren't there. Everybody with me on that? It's just like what we saw before, where a hydrogen can jump from molecule to molecule where it has different positions because of what the neighbors are, and you average it out and get just one peak. So you can average out the effect of that neighboring hydrogen without going from molecule to molecule, just by making that hydrogen flip up and down rapidly. Okay, so then what we'll see is that that splitting will go away and we'll get a single peak in the middle. And that's called proton decoupling. It removes the splitting that's caused by the hydrogens if you do that. Okay? So it's just a question of this dynamic averaging that we talked about last time. Okay, now, so here's some examples of spectra. Now, the spectra, notice, are C13 spectra. We're not looking at protons, we're looking at C13. But, of course, the carbon-13 is influenced by the protons that are around, spin-spin splitting. And the C13 has certain chemical shift. So here are the chemical shifts measured from tetramethylsilane, TMS, as zero. But notice, what about the scale here of carbon peaks? You remember how big the scale was on hydrogen? Went how big? To about 10 in the most dramatic cases. Here it goes to 200. Right? So carbon is much more variable, which doesn't surprise you. What is it that causes chemical shift? What phenomenon is going on in the molecule, Henry? Pardon me? Electron cloud orbiting. There are a lot more electrons around carbon than there are around hydrogen, so that doesn't surprise you. Okay, but anyhow, here we can see that there's splitting by hydrogen. So, for example, this carbon is not split. There are no hydrogens connected to it. This one has a single hydrogen, so it's a doublet. This one turns out to be from the solvent. It's the carbon, remember we're looking at carbon, it's the carbon that's in the solvent, carbon deuterium, Cl3. So deuterium is not spin a half. In fact, it turns out that deuterium is magnetic, weakly, but it has spin 1, which means it has 3 orientations, but it's a weak magnet, so it doesn't split very much. So what you see here is actually 3 peaks very, very close to one another. So you know that's the one that has deuterium on it. Then what? This one has CH2, right? It's a triplet split by 2 hydrogens. And here is a CH2, 2 peaks, and also a 3 peaks, 1 to 2 to 1, and also underneath it, 1 to 3 to 3 to 1, a quartet from a methyl group. Everybody understand that? Okay, now notice one thing, that you can't use integrals in C13 spectroscopy the way you do in proton spectroscopy. In protons, they're all the same. In C13, there are complications due to relaxation that we don't need to talk about, that mean that carbon-13s in different environments have different intrinsic intensities. Not true of protons, but true of C13. So that you can't rely on the integral with carbon the way you can with hydrogen. But anyhow, you know you have a carbon that has no hydrogens, there's 2 of them that have 1 hydrogen, 2 of them that have 2 hydrogens, and 1 that have 3 hydrogens. And then you try to figure out, you know, solve the puzzle, what could the molecule be that had that? And you know not only how many hydrogens there are, but you know what the chemical shift is here. Right? Now, what I want to show you with this slide is not that, but what happens as you change the power at 100 megahertz, which is decoupling, right? Which is making the hydrogens flip up and down. So here, a big number here, it's an inverse logarithmic ratio, so it means very little extra power being put in to hit the hydrogens while you're looking at carbon. Now, if you put a little more in, what I did is squash the spectrum down so these would be on the same scale, this one and the following ones. Because you see, as you put more power in the hydrogens, the peaks start getting bigger. It turns out that there are fancy things that happen that's called nuclear Overhauser enhancement. You can try that one on your roommate too if you want. Okay? Which means that if you irradiate some nuclei while you're looking at others, it strengthens the signal from the others. And that's why you can't trust the integral, because this phenomenon is going on. Okay, but anyhow, here we're doing it again, and again we... But now, notice, remember what that was before, this peak? You remember what it was a couple slides back? It was a doublet. Now it's beginning to collapse. A singlet is growing in the middle of the doublet. And if we increase the power more, it becomes a singlet. And when we have enough power, they're all singlets. Right? We removed all the coupling from the hydrogen. So this is decoupling the hydrogen. And now we just have a single peak for each kind of hydrogen, for each kind of carbon. So this is carbon, this is CH, CH, CH2, CH3, CH2. We knew that before, right, when we could see the splitting, how many hydrogens. But you can also get information about it now. Because you notice this peak, the CDCl3 carbon, was very big originally relative to the others. Now it's very small. Can you see why it's very small? Yeah. Right? It's because we're irradiating the protons to decouple them. And when you do that, the carbon peaks attached get stronger. But this one doesn't have any protons to be irradiated, so it doesn't get stronger. Okay, but anyhow, that's decoupling. And now you have, you're left with information also from the chemical shift. But notice that there's this stuff called NOE, nuclear Overhauser enhancement. That's the thing you can, if your roommates aren't impressed by diamagnetic anisotropy, tell them about nuclear Overhauser enhancement. Yeah.
Why don't magnetic carbons split on?
Okay, that's exactly the next thing we're going to get to. Okay, so the RF excitation of a nucleus strengthens a signal from nearby nuclei, which is bad for integration. But it's good for something else. It's good for determining structure. If nearby protons influence the strength of a signal, you know which protons are nearby, and I'm going to show you how you use that later. But first, notice that carbon 13 is only 1% of carbon, unless you specifically label a molecule with high concentration of C13. Now we come to Brian's. Well, no, it's the next thing, Brian's question. Okay, so here's a proton-decoupled C13 spectrum, and it's from Neotame, which is a very powerful artificial sweetener. So you've probably tasted it in fruit drinks and things like that. But this is the molecule, and this is its NMR spectrum, right? And it's been proton-decoupled. It's a C13 spectrum, proton-decoupled, so there's no splitting. Each of these peaks is a carbon of a given chemical shift. Now, let's just think about, it's proton decoupled, so there's one peak per carbon, and notice that they're pretty well spread out, because we can go to 200 parts per million, so it's much broader than you have in protons. Okay? But, this is the question that was just asked, why don't you see C13 splitting? We're irradiating the protons, so that goes away, but we should still see C13 splitting, shouldn't we? Anybody solve that problem? Why isn't there C-Don?
I guess basically C13 is so rare.
Yeah, if you're a C13 in this molecule, what's the chance that the next door carbon is C13? 1%. You won't see it, right? They're 100 times weaker, right? Only 1% of the C13s that you're looking at have a C13 neighbor in the same molecule. It has to be in the same molecule to do it, right? So you don't see C13 splitting unless you specifically enrich C13. Okay? And we'll show that in a second. But now, these things come at different chemical shifts. And the way people figured this out is empirical. They take a compound of known structure, take the spectrum, see where the peaks come. Take a related molecule, see which peaks are the same. Take another molecule, see which peaks are the same, which peaks are different. And figure out what chemical shift goes with what proton, or with what C13 in this case. Okay, but let's just see if we can figure out, given what the assignment here, what there's... So way down, far down in the parts per million, at high chemical shift, there's carbons 1, 13, and 4. Can you see what those are due to? What kind of carbons come way down there at 180 or something? Well, yeah, they're definitely deshielded, but what causes? How do you recognize in the molecule? What's it telling you about what kind of functional groups are in the molecule? Okay.
Stuck there.
It could be, but look. But take a hint here and look. What is it that did it? What do 1, 13, and 4 have in common?
Oh.
Kaylin, you got it now.
They all have the double bonded O.
Yeah, they're carbonyl groups. Okay, so those are C double bond O, come way down. Now, how about the next group? Kaylin, I'm going to come back to you on that. This one. Right? So those are 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. Notice that 7 and 10 are on the axis of symmetry of this benzene. So if the benzene can rotate, they don't change. Right? But the others, these two change and these two change. So those 8, 9, 11, and 12 are broader peaks than 7 and 10. But don't worry about that. That's just something to notice. Okay, but anyhow, that's where aromatic ones come. Now, how about the others? Can you see anything that tells us about the others? How about these ones that are deshielded a little bit? 3, 5, 14, 15. 3, 5, 14, 15, 2, as compared to 17, 18, 19, 20. Yeah.
They're right next to electronegative.
They're next to electronegative groups. So as in the case of hydrogen, they get pulled downfield a little bit. Right? So I'm not going to require you to memorize these things. If you ever start using NMR, you'll quickly enough learn what goes where. Right? But the idea that as you pull electrons away, they get deshielded, that's reasonable for you to remember. Okay, but you can see how you could, by studying lots of known molecules, you could make up a table of chemical shifts and then be able to solve the structure of completely unknown molecules by what the chemical shifts are and what the spin-spin splitting pattern is. Here, of course, it's decoupled. So those are ones with electronegative, and those are just alkanes. And there are other things like they find that when a carbon is strained or when it's particularly crowded, it has predictable correlated changes in the chemical shift, but we don't need to go into that. Okay, now, the rest of this lecture about NMR is about the power of correlation. And there are going to be three examples I give. And the first is dilute C13 double labeling. So you're going to make molecules that have C13 in them, but you're going to make molecules that have two C13s in them, double labeling. Okay, now let's see how that works. And it has to do with what we've already talked about before in lecture 52 and is mentioned in the book, this lanosterol biosynthesis, which you remember from last time. You had squalene that was put together from isoprene units, and then the fairy story I told you was that you epoxidize it and then open the ring and you get these cations, and the rings start zipping up, and you get all these different rings that are present in steroids, and you get that cation. And remember then what happened next? Right? Then you take neighboring groups and you start moving them. You have a hydride shift, then another hydride shift, and then a methide shift, and then another methide shift. And what happened next? Then you lose a proton, right? And you get this stuff called lanosterol, which is where cholesterol and steroid hormones come from. So that was a fun story. But as I told you at the time, there's a question of whether it's true. And I said, wait for NMR. Now we're at NMR. So we're going to see how people confirm this scheme. Okay, so they used the C13 label. So they made the squalene biologically by feeding the organism isopentenyl pyrophosphate that had a C13 enriched in that position. Now, you get squalene out of that, but certain of the most of the carbons in the squalene will be normal carbon 12. But the ones that were enriched with C13 will give peaks that are ever so much stronger, right? Rather than 1%, they'll be 5% or 10%, depending on how much C13 you put in. could be 100% if you put in that much C13. At these particular chemical shifts, okay? So then you'd know that squalene got made from this. But we're not interested in squalene, we're interested in lanosterol. So if we then take the squalene and make it into lanosterol, we get carbons in those positions which are enriched. And if they're 100% enriched here, they'll be 100 times stronger than the other carbon peaks in the spectrum. And it'll be specifically these carbons, if this story I told you was correct, and that's how it works out. Those carbons in those chemical shifts are 100 times stronger, the peaks, than the others. Okay, or you could label this one in the starting material, in which case all those methyl groups get labeled. And that's true in squalene, and it's also true in lanosterol. So far, so good. Right? But a much more powerful technique is to do double labeling. Right? So now we're going to put these two in, which will label those in squalene and these in lanosterol. Now, you won't be, so far it looks like I haven't added any information, right? Because we did them independently and saw that they went in that position. So big surprise that if you do them both, they come in those positions. But can you see what the trick is of having two of them in there if it's dilute? So you don't put very many molecules in that have C13, but the ones you put in are double labeled. What phenomenon would you see if you had 100% labeling here? How would these spectra look different? Yeah, they'd show C13 coupling, right? Because the neighbor is C13 too, which normally it's not. Right? But if they were double labeled, they would. Now, that's true if it was 100%. These would be 100% bigger and so on. But suppose you put it in dilute, not very much C13 labeled. Now what's the chance that your neighbor will be C13? Not very good. Unless, if you make it dilute, very few single precursor molecules have any C13 label. But those that are labeled have two C13s. So now, in the product, it might be that this molecule, the molecule that gave these five carbons here, right? The molecule that gave those five carbons might have been labeled. And none of the others were labeled because it was dilute. But when this is C13, this is also C13. Because they came from the same molecule. Got it? So what will you see in the spectrum?
Split.
Right. If it's proton decoupled, you don't see any splitting from protons, you'll see a double doublet. A doublet for at this chemical shift and a doublet at this chemical shift because they split each other. Okay? Now, that would be some of the molecules. There would be other molecules. There would be other molecules. So what I wanted to say is, it proves that they entered as a unit, not independently, because if they came in independently, they wouldn't both be labeled in the same molecule, right? Now, there'll be other molecules that where that was labeled in squalene, and this pair, again, it'll be a double doublet, and there will be a double doublet, and there will be a double doublet. But what's going to be special if the story I told you was true?
Yeah.
There were methide shifts that moved carbons relative to their neighbors. So when you look at these two carbons, they're singlets. Right? They came in together, but they're not next to one another. So they don't split one another. Or if you look at those two, they're singlets. Right? So this absolutely confirms the idea that these rearrangements took place, these methide shifts. Okay? So those two atoms are both labeled, both C13, in the same molecule, but they're not coupled, right? These two are both labeled in the sample, but not in the same molecule. So isn't that a cute experiment to show that these rearrangements took place in some cases and not others? Okay, so that's the idea, is to correlate things with one another, to see that this one comes together with this one. Okay, so the dilute double label experiment enhances the same 12 C13 peaks as the single label experiments. Big deal. But only eight of them show spin-spin splitting because their carbon-carbon bond stayed intact and the others had a shift. Okay, so this strongly confirms the rearrangement scheme that I told you about before, and it shows the power of correlation. So now I'm going to show another example of correlation in NMR, and that will conclude our NMR, and then we'll show one other type of correlation in chromatography. So this is what's called a two-dimensional NMR spectrum. And technically how you do it is pretty complicated. You use pulses of different frequencies at different intervals and times and so on. And that's a big deal for NMR jocks, is to figure out what sequences you use to make things precess at certain times and not at others, and which things precess. And we won't talk about that, but just tell you what you see in such a spectrum. Along the diagonal, there are lots and lots of peaks. And that's the same peak, along that line is what you'd see in a normal spectrum. And this is the 2D spectrum of a protein. It's a polymer, so it has lots and lots of these units in it, hundreds probably. So in this short region of the spectrum here, a narrow range, it's mostly the hydrogens attached to nitrogens of amide groups like this. But there are a whole bunch of them because there are 100 units in this protein. So they're all on top of one another over this chemical shift range, right? How are you going to unscramble them? Well, by doing this fancy technique where you correlate responses to frequencies in this range, while at the same time you're putting other signals in this range, you generate what are called off-diagonal peaks. So you get peaks that are not along the diagonal, and you can see they're not congested. They're well separated from one another, right? And what those mean is that when you have an NH that comes at this chemical shift, 7.25, right? When you have that one, it somehow interacts with others that have these chemical shifts, right? So it interacts through space, right? And it has to do with this nuclear Oberhauser enhancement, which, remember, means that the irradiating one signal affects the intensity of the others. So you're looking at this one, right? And while you're also exciting in this range, and you see what other frequencies influence the intensity you see for this peak. Okay? And that means they're within 6 angstroms of one another. And you, so there's the one that's at delta 8.9, the one at 8.3, 8.25, and 7.7 are all within 6 angstroms of 7.25. Now, some of those peaks are stronger than the others because they're closer. So you don't measure the precise distance between them. You just group them into these are pretty close. These are sort of intermediate, like these are between van der Waals contact and 2.5 angstroms. These are within 2 angstroms and 3.5 angstroms. These are within 3 angstroms and 6 angstroms, think something like that. So you, short, medium, long. Okay, but you know something about which of these hydrogens are near that particular hydrogen. Okay, now. Professor Loria, who does this kind of thing to determine protein structures, analogizes this to deriving the geography of a town by having its phone book. Some phone books in the early pages have a map of the town. This one, that page is torn out. All you have is the phone numbers of a bunch of people. How do you figure out who's where? Okay, so you take a number and you call it and you say, can you tell me three or four people who live nearest to you? And they say, oh yeah, Joe Blow and so on and so on. So now you call Joe Blow. Can you tell me who lives sort of near you? Joe Blow says, oh, these guys. So you call them. And after a while you find out who's near to who, near to who, near to who. And there'll be a map that has this property. You see how that would work? So this is the same thing. You find out which protons are near other protons, and those then are near other protons. So 7.25 is near 7.9, which is near 8.0, which is near blah, blah, blah. Got the idea? Okay. So You identify which amino acid it is by seeing that this proton couples with this proton, couples with the R group, which tells you which amino acid it is. Right? And then, using molecular mechanics constraints, you know, if you just knew that these are sort of near or sort of far and so on, but still within 6 angstroms, that doesn't tell you precisely. But if you know that you have to have certain bond lengths and bond angles and so on, and you don't want to bend them very much, then you can tell short, intermediate, long together with molecular mechanics and get the precise structure of the molecule. Okay, so you can get the 3D structure without having to make a crystal, which is often very tough in proteins. So this is how structures of proteins are determined by NMR, which is a big industry nowadays. Okay, you can also do correlation in time. So here's the spectrum along the diagonal, the spectrum you'd normally see, 4 peaks. For the hydrogens of the methyl groups in this cation. It's a cation. It's in very strong acid, so it's stable as a cation. Now, that, I've drawn one resonance structure of that cation, spectrum is backwards. This is the highest chemical shift, and this is the lowest. And the reason is that the blue and the green ones, the blue and the green, are near positive charge. Therefore, they're deshielded because the charge shields things. Because you have these resonance structures, or look up there, you can draw that resonance structure, which means you have special positive charge here and here and here. So the blue ones and the green one are shifted downfield. Okay, not so much the purple, and especially not the red ones, which aren't near positive charge. Okay, now, in a short time, 0.3 seconds at 40 degrees, you get rearrangements where a methyl group can move to another position. So these methyl groups that are colored here become these after it rearranges, if the methyl moves to the next carbon. Okay? Now, that's a methide shift, and I've shown a 1-2 methide shift, moves from one carbon to the next carbon to give this. But how do I know that it's a 1-2 shift? Might it be a 1-anything shift? Right? For example, you could start here, and then the methyl group could move into above the middle of the ring, and then come down wherever, say down in the bottom left. So it would be a 1-3 shift. Or it could come down to the bottom and be a 1-4 shift. So does it move around the ring by making 1-2 methide shifts? Or is it one to the middle and then anywhere shifts? Well, that's what the 2D spectrum can show you. Because if you do this particular kind of 2D spectrum, and don't expect to understand how it's done because that's pretty technical and I'm not doing it, but it has to do with whether irradiating one signal influences another signal. And that would obviously happen if you irradiate this signal, but then it moves down here. It becomes, the red one moves down here, but that leaves this red one in a different position from what it was before. It got irradiated here, but now it's in a different position. And that turns out to generate an off-diagonal peak. So we see that C and A exchange with one another because there's an off-diagonal peak. So C could become A. And the same rearrangement in the opposite direction would take an A signal and make it become a C signal. But in this particular way of doing the spectroscopy, that generates this off-diagonal peak. But you see, there are other off-diagonal peaks too. You can have D become B. So D becomes B. And you can have B become C. Okay, those peaks all appear off-diagonal. But you don't have A to B or C to D or A to D, right? Because you can't go directly from one of those to the others. So the rearrangement must be 1-2, not 1-anywhere. If it could go anywhere, you'd get all these possibilities. But you only get those, which show interesting information about the mechanism of the reaction. through this two-dimensional NMR spectroscopy. And now we'll close with this. So that's correlation in time. How quickly does it go from one place to another? It can go further, but it takes longer. Okay? And the way the pulses are done in the NMR is such that it has to be within 0.3 of a second in order to show these peaks. And here's a picture of the spectrum in three dimensions, so you can see those peaks we talked about before with the off-diagonal peaks. It shows how intense they are. Okay, and the last kind of correlation. So we had correlation in space, these two C13s that came together, correlation in time, which peaks can go to which other ones. And now correlation in chromatography, which is a completely different thing, but again illustrates the power of correlation. So you've done TLC, and you know you can take a mixture of a bunch of stuff and get a bunch of peaks, and then you can put an authentic sample in a different lane and see where it runs, and it looks like it's probably maybe one of those two, but who knows. Now, what they were studying here was the partially purified extract from some brown algae, and they were looking for steroids that influence the shedding of the exoskeleton by insects. These ecdy steroids, as they're called, they influence ecdysis. So they're looking to see whether this brown algae has a particular steroid that they put here. This is a class of steroids, so they put one of them here. So does it have it or not? Well, maybe, maybe not. One thing you could do is, instead of using this solvent mixture, you could use some different solvent mixture where things would run at different relative rates. So you could, here's that authentic steroid that they put here, but the question is that in this? Okay. And now you can do another one and run the solvent up the thing here and put the same sample in there, and it looks like it might be that, but who knows which of these peaks are which of these peaks. Okay? But a neat thing you can do is to correlate those two so that you know that a given peak in this one corresponds exactly to a given peak in that one. And the way you do it is to do two-dimensional chromatography. So you take a sheet that's like this, and first you spot it here and first run this way, then you let the plate dry and there are going to be peaks all along here, and then you turn it 90 degrees and put the solvent in and let it run up that way. Right? So this peak is the one that was here and also the one that was here. Right? And it spreads them out much more in two dimensions, so they're not on top of one another anymore. But still, you don't know for sure. We didn't put an authentic sample of A in when we did it in two dimensions. Right? But there's actually another dimension to this, which is color. Because it turns out, so you got much better resolution in 2D. And it turns out that if you spray vanillin and sulfuric acid on there, the ones that are these ecdy steroids turn turquoise color. So now you know that this one is that, but it's not the same. It's of that class of molecules, but it's not the same one you put in. Okay? But anyhow, this is to show correlation between what happens in one solvent and what happens in another, which spreads things out and makes interpretation easier, as it was in 2D NMR. Yeah, Victor?
Can't you see that color from
a single? Yeah, you can. So this was not actually particularly useful. You're on top of the situation in answering the question I posed. But what it illustrates is how much better resolution you can get by using two dimensions rather than just one dimension where things are all on top of one another. And it also shows which peaks here are which peaks here by doing it that way. Okay, that's enough for now.
NMR to tell that there were the methide shifts. Does that mean we'd have to use NMR at the moment before this shifts happen?
No, you can only, you only take the spectrum after you've already isolated the product.
Oh, okay.
You don't look at it as it's going on. That, while it's going on, are these things, this 2D NMR stuff was while the stuff was actually happening, you see, which peaks appear. But this one, you just look at the product and tell whether things that were together in this original starting material are still together in the product.
Okay, I see.
Good. Okay.